Shalom Chevery. My friends, we have discovered the divine accent in Breshit, that is, Genesis. Perhaps, initially, to our surprise, we found that this God-inspired book of 50 chapters devoted no less than 39 of them to recording the divine dealings with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. We sought the reason for this unexpected emphasis, which rested not upon the vastness of all creation, but upon these four minute specks of its component dust. We found our answer to this enigma in Eden, where we viewed the loss introduced by Satan and the legacy announced by the Eternal. The blessed legacy of redemption through the promised seed of the woman. We identified and traced the early origins of the seed of the serpent, and we likewise discovered and followed the early origins of the seed of the woman. It was a happy and refreshing task, and it showed us that redemption was the great divine objective and selectivity, the divine principle preparing it. In dismissing into a mere 11 opening chapters so much with so great potential, God seems to be rushing to the side of the man he condescended to call his friend. I refer to Abraham. Here's a name to fire the fancy. In the first decade of the 19th century of the Common Era, there died a man called Abraham Newland. He was the principal cashier of the Bank of England. On his tomb, there appeared these lines, which he wrote himself, obviously, of course, before his death. Beneath this stone, old Abraham lies. Nobody laughs and nobody cries. Where he has gone and how he fares, nobody knows. And nobody cares. Now I suspect this custodian of a bank's wealth wrote well. Nobody knows, and nobody cares. But never could such a morbid sentiment be associated with our Abraham, the Abraham of Genesis. He stands forth in a blaze of glory, the custodian of untold spiritual wealth. Why, Abraham's bosom is the poetic expression employed to describe heaven itself. With whom there is no place of toil, no burning heat, no piercing cold, nor any briars there, this place we call the bosom of Abraham. Our ancient Jewish sages include Abraham amongst the five great possessions of God, for we read in the Mishnah, five possessions did the Holy One, Baruch Hu, blessed be He, take to Himself in His world. And these are they. The law is one possession. And the heaven and earth are one possession. Abraham is one possession. Israel is one possession. And the temple is one possession. What was the secret of Abraham's superlative greatness? Well, negatively, he stands out for his courage in changing his religion when he found it to be false. And, positively, he is prominent for his heart attitude of faith in God. We have seen that man's loss was caused through unfaith. Disobedience was due to lack of implicit trust in God. It is poetically right, then, that man must reverse this attitude in order to resume fellowship and relationship with God. The whole Bible teaches that faith is the basis upon which God imputes righteousness to human beings who decide that God is loveworthy and trustworthy. In other words, the scriptures teach the principle of imputed righteousness through faith. And our father Abraham appears as a supreme example of this divine principle, showing that true faith is always active. On this point, listen carefully to the declaration of the Torah, the law. I read from Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6. The Ha'amin Badonai V'yakshaveha lo tzedakah. A passage of scripture which the great Sephardic rabbi, the Reverend D.A. de Solar, translates as follows. And he believed in the Lord, who accounted it to him as righteousness. Both Rashi and Sforno concur that God accounted this faith shown by Abraham as righteousness. Says Rashi, and here I quote him, "The Holy One, blessed be He, accounted it unto Abraham as a merit, because of the faith with which he had trusted in him." That is the end of the quotation. My friends, here is an early revelation of a divine principle, the principle of imputed righteousness consequent upon faith. Note and treasure that principle. It has never been divinely waived or rescinded. It is still operative today. Through faith, placed, of course, where God directs, the soul is reunited to the eternal. Similarly, with and through such a soul, the eternal works for humanity's emancipation from sin's bondage. For not only was Abraham the recipient of divinely imputed righteousness, but he was also the repository of an amplification of the earlier divine legacy of promise in Eden, the full effect of which this world has yet to witness. Thus, the four super-significant lives of Genesis carried the divine accent because they carried the divine legacy. Abraham, himself justified by an active faith, became the crucible, yea, the very crucible, into which was poured the totality of the divine content of God's beneficent intentions toward mankind. Now here is something that will surely interest you. Indeed, I think it may possibly startle you. Is it not true that at mention of Abraham, your mind conjures a figure almost lost in the press of the multitudes and myriads of the remote ages of the past? You glance over your shoulder, backward over the time strip behind you, peering over the heaven-saluting heads of humanity. But where stands Abraham among so many? But if only I could twist that long time strip round laterally so that it faces you, I am sure you would be surprised at the point in it at which you would discover Abraham. Let me borrow your imagination a moment, and I think we can achieve this discovery just the same. Imagine the nearest edge of your rectangular table to be a biblical time strip, 4,000 years long. At one end stands the first man, Adam, in Eden. At the other end, 4,000 years away from Adam, stands one who was responsible for cutting the present calendar in twain like the halving of an apple, so that people measure time from the point at which he stands as B.C. and A.D. Incidentally, the scriptures of the New Testament designate this one as the last Adam, the second man, 1 Corinthians 15. Now this designation makes our experiment very simple. At one end of the table is the first Adam, at the other end of the table is the last Adam, and between them stretches a biblical time strip of 4,000 years. Now, where along this time strip is your cooperative imagination going to place our great father Abraham? You don't know? Well, are you ready for the surprise? Good. Abraham stands exactly halfway. Biblical chronology places Abraham 2,000 years from the first man in Eden and 2,000 years from the second man in Israel. Is Abraham's centrality a surprise to you? Does it not arrest your attention to discover that Abraham is exactly halfway between the creation of man and the beginning of the common era? Surely a most interesting discovery. Whilst it is admitted that the chronology of Tanakh can oft-times be only an approximation, yet the approximation can demonstrate comfortably the remarkable chronological position occupied by Abraham. So far from occupying a random place in the multitude, Abraham is the chronologically central figure in the whole age before the common era. Think in terms of a triangle, and Abraham is the very apex. That is rather arresting, isn't it? Now we see a structure in Revelation, not to be denied. Now we see again that not the manifold ologies inherent in creation, but rather the legacy in its promise and progress towards complete performance is the supreme subject of the divine interest. Let us, too, transfer our interest where the eternal Baruch Hu, blessed be He, has His. Yivarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'hunecha. Yisar Adonai panav elecha v'yashem lecha shalom. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make His face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up His countenance upon thee and give thee peace.